Welcome to Season 5, Episode 1 of Beyond the Zero. I'm your host, Ben. Joining me today is Ali Miller. Ali is a writer, and her brand new novel, Ava Anna Ada, is out on January 18th from White Rabbit Books. Welcome to the show, Ali.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for joining me. It is a pleasure to speak with you. And you're joining me from Hastings in the UK, which is down on the south coast. Do you want to tell us about life down there? Because you just moved.
Yeah, moved last month. And I would 100% recommend not moving just before you have a book out. Probably like the most chaotic thing to do. And just before Christmas as well. But life down here is great. It's really laid back. There's the beach very close. So I'm at the beach most days. There's lots of little indie shops, quirky shops. It's like a fishing town as well. So I think it's got like Britain's largest beach launch fishing fleet. So there's no harbour. The boats just go out from the beach and then they bring fish back and sell the fish in wee huts all along the beach as well. So it's really lovely and it's very different to London. It's got its own real distinct identity. It's not kind of like a London satellite town. And it's laid back and people are friendly and everyone talks to you and they're not just rushing around and banging into you and stuff. So it's been a revelation, actually. It's a really nice wee place.
Yeah, because you were living in London for quite a long time and that is an insane city. It is so busy and so expensive. And I can totally see why you'd move to Hastings. But like your life in London, how was that for you?
Oh, it was great. And I am actually kind of being one of those really annoying people that's trying to manage to still do both. So I'm in London quite a lot and trying to sort of squeeze the life out of London as well as being here. But London was brilliant, but maybe too brilliant. There's so much going on. There's kind of culturally so much happening that you can always be doing something instead of actually at home writing books, which is obviously what I'm supposed to be doing. But it's brilliant. It's such a vibrant city. But I got to the stage last year when I would be away doing book promo or at book festivals and things, and then I would come back to London and I kind of wasn't looking forward to coming back to London. Or when I was in London, I would be counting down to leaving it. And I thought, well, if the only way that you can kind of cope with living in the city is by being out the city a lot, then how much do you really like the city that you live in? And I think it just got to the stage. It was a bit too frenetic. Felt like I was always on the tube or on the night bus or in an Uber. So life here is definitely a little bit more relaxed.
Yeah. And how are your children enjoying the new place?
They love it. So they liked London, they liked the museums and they liked the art galleries, but they hated the tube, particularly the Northern Line. They all like took offense at the Northern Line. I think it's maybe the noisiest line. So they love it here because we can just go down to the beach. They can go to the beach after school and it's a shingle beach as well. And I thought they might be annoyed because it's not sand, but they love the stones, just throwing stones into the sea. So it seems to, so far, touch wood, it's all working.
Okay, that's brilliant. So you grew up in Edinburgh and in that border between the UK and Scotland. So I want to go back to that kind of childhood and how was life growing up over there?
We're about 40 miles south of Edinburgh in the Borders. And the Borders is a very kind of self-contained insular world. And people don't really come to it because there's no reason for them to come. So they'll pass through on the train. But after the 1960s and a lot of there was rail networks all in the Borders and they all got taken out. So basically the train just goes through between Berwick and Edinburgh. Then nobody really gets off the train and goes into the Borders. Right. So I always had this sense that we were in quite a unique place and it's beautiful. It's very beautiful, but I got this feeling that kind of actually was really important in developing Ava Anna Ada, actually, that I was living somewhere that was so small, but that smallness showed me how big the world was. I always understood that there was somewhere else. And I think when you're in a city, sometimes you can become very insular without realizing it, because you've got everything you need. You don't need to look elsewhere. Whereas when you grow up, and we would drive home from the meetings late at night, and I would just look at the stars from the car window, or I would look at the moon, and it kind of showed how far away everything was, but I always knew there was somewhere else. And also it's funny because I could describe it in quite an idyllic way. And I think the temptation is to describe it idyllically. We had very distinct seasons. So every winter there would definitely be a snow week where you wouldn't get to school, and we would sledge outside till we were freezing cold. And that the freedom to do that was great. It was really good fun. And in the summer, we would spend long days at the beach because we had beaches nearby. We had hills, we had woods. So we did have that, but we also had the isolation of growing up somewhere that was very rural and very small, somewhere where there wasn't much opportunity. So my mom had been a school teacher before I was born, and then she'd given up work, as a lot of women do. And then my father left, so she didn't have a job and had a little child. And it was really hard for her to get teaching work because there was like three schools, you know, whereas if she'd been in the city, it would have been much more opportunity. And I think that it can be so tempting to kind of go, oh, we're surrounded by nature, isn't that wonderful? And we exalt that and kind of are suspicious of the man-made and the city, which is, goes back to kind of biblical ideas as well. Without talking about the kind of endemic poverty that a lot of these places have, and because it was the borders, I think that it's a very overlooked part of the country as well, particularly when after Scotland became devolved. It's kind of not close enough to any centre of power to matter that much as well. So, so far away from Westminster, but also it's not Glasgow, it's not Edinburgh, and the borders is really, is farming, it's farmland, it's there to feed the rest of Scotland. So it was a really interesting place to grow up. It was also the kind of place where you knew if you were in the upper streams at school and you were doing well, that you were going to leave. It was always this kind of temporary place, that there was opportunity elsewhere again, which I think helps with that worldview of actually realizing that things are happening everywhere else. And it's a place that I think I've got quite a complicated relationship with. And that kind of complexity worked its way into Eva and Ada. Of course, it starts with the line, not Scotland, not England, not Europe, not Europe, so that we immediately get a sense that this is a in-between space, that this is a space that doesn't really understand its own identity. But definitely, if it doesn't understand its identity, nobody else is understanding it. And yeah, I became quite preoccupied with this idea of overlooked places. And I don't think I would have had that preoccupation if I'd grown up somewhere urban, but also because I grew up close enough to Edinburgh, there was a sense of, here's where I want to be, here's a place that I really connect with and I like, and there's lights and there's things happening. But also because it was a borderland, I went to high school in England, but lived in Scotland. So I would cross over the border every day. And there's a really funny accent actually in Berwick, which has been English and been Scottish so many times. And the accent is kind of this like half Geordie, half Scottish. It's this like real mashup of the nearest places. It becomes its own accent. And that kind of collision between Englishness and Scottishness always really fascinated me too. And of how much is, you know, how much of nationality is a construct as well.
So interesting. Okay. Well, the reason I wanted to ask you that question especially was because we get to know you quite well in your book, which was unbelievable. I just loved your book, The Last Days. But it recounts your journey through childhood and adolescence within these cloistered walls of the Jehovah's Witnesses and your exit from that world. But for those who haven't read it, do you want to give us a bit of a background into that kind of world that you grew up in?
Yeah, so it, again, it was living in this very insular, isolated place was obviously exacerbated by being part of this kind of very closed system. And so when you're a Jehovah's Witness, language is deployed in a really interesting way. So we were told that outside of us was the world. Everyone was worldly, and inside this religion was where we would be saved and where we were safe. I was told that we were safe at the Kingdom Hall. I would spend about 5 hours a week at the Kingdom Hall. Thursday nights, we were there for a two-hour meeting. Sunday mornings, we were there for a two-hour meeting, and then we'd have field service afterwards. Saturday, you went on ministry. Tuesday nights, you went to someone's house to do a book study. So it was a very busy religion. My time was always taken up. I was always occupied. And so it was also a funny thing of a very kind of lonely childhood, because I wasn't to see people outside, and I was very aware of the other kids at school and the fact that, you know, Christmas was something really exciting to them. And Christmas Day for me was you're not allowed to do anything. And yet at the same time, I was always around other people and other people that I at that point believed were my friends as well. And it's only later that you realize that that's kind of all temporary too. And so I wanted in the last days to bring that world alive, but I didn't want to signpost the reader. I didn't want to be like, this was awful and these people are awful and you must feel a certain way. I wanted to bring it alive, and the best way to do that was, so it's unusually for memoir, first person present tense, so that I take the reader from when I'm 2 to when I'm nearly 30, and that kind of line of growing up and believing something to be true, and then the kind of shakiness of seeing the world outside and wanting to be part of that, but being pulled back because I believed that I'd die if I left, and I knew I would lose my mother as well. So the kind of push and pull of desire, it's really a book about desire. It's a book about freedom as well. But yeah, I just wanted to bring it alive through the eyes of a child.
It's honestly, it's one of those memoirs that I read and I was so sucked into. And I love that we were talking about this, we started recording about, I guess, the permission to write these kind of books and also the respect that you have to write these kind of books. And you tread that line so beautifully within this book because you're subtle and you've obviously got you have the experience to write this book, and you just do it in such a beautiful, subtle manner. And it's also it's an enthralling, interesting read. And I feel like through this book, we get to know you in a really personal way. We get to know, you know, that community in a really personal way. And I just think it's an unbelievable memoir.
Thank you. I think when you're writing a book that is a book bearing witness to people who've been othered, you know, I grew up feeling very othered and very distinctly different, and with the kind of conflicts of knowing I was meant to feel good about that, but I felt bad about that. But I didn't want to do that to a whole community. You know, I really just wanted to show what life was like and to bear witness to that complexity, and also to show how people have been manipulated by an organization much bigger than them with pretty nefarious intent. It's not the people at the ground level who are to blame in any way. So it was very important to have that element of respect. And it also became important for me to feel like it was done properly and in a not just in a respectful way, but that it was as close to truth as possible. And of course, as soon as narrative comes into it, particularly a subjective narrative, you're never going to get the truth, but truth can sometimes just be that representing and replicating a particular experience, which is what I wanted to do. And I mean, since I've had so many messages from people all over the world who've said, yes, that's what it was like for me, or who've said that's the first time I ever saw that.
Yeah.
Other people who said that it helped them understand what was happening to them in new ways as well. So I think that's kind of all you can hope for from your work, is that someone else can latch on to something and see their experience in it. So you don't ever need to bring necessarily anything new. I'm not sure there is anything new at this stage to say, but you can definitely do something that can keep someone company maybe at 2 in the morning.
Yeah. One of the things you write towards the end of that book, and this is after you've, you know, had your son who you called Alexander in the book, and you write that writing and reading freed you. But I want to ask you, was there a catalyst that made you pursue like this passion for literature?
Yes, sort of. I mean, thinking about this a lot, it was a very similar question that I was asked the other day. I think that I always loved books. I instinctively loved books. There's a bit in The Last Days where I recount being 3 and sitting at the bottom of these bookshelves and looking up and seeing all these books above my head and being very aware kind of the currency of a book. So my sister was 6 years older than me, and her and my mother used to sit and have conversations at dinner about what they'd been reading. And I was too young to take part because I couldn't read. Mm. And I felt so left out. I hated it. So I remember sitting at the bottom of these bookshelves crying and my mum picking me up and saying, you know, what's up? And I said, I can't read. I want you to teach me to read. And she was a school teacher. And by the end of the day, she'd pretty much taught me how to do it. And so I read really precociously young. And funnily enough, for a uber religious household, so this is kind of my mom's conflict, I think. She was very middle class growing up, and her parents were very well educated and were big readers. And my mother is a big reader. And there were obviously a lot of books that she wouldn't have in the house, but I was allowed to read anything that was in the house, even when I was very young. Mm-hmm. So she didn't, you know, so nothing was off limits. I remember she read me Jane Eyre when I was, before I went to school, I'm pretty sure, because I remember being on her knee and her reading the scene in the Red Room. And that was the most visceral and incredible scene. I still think it's one of the best scenes, just the horror in that scene. And so I always loved books. And as I got older and wanted to escape the real world I was in, then books were the place I went. They were somewhere else to go. And then when I left the Witnesses, like I mentioned to you, I was so busy. When I was a witness, there was so much of my time that was taken up every week. I mean, and you actually had to account for your time. So at that stage, you used to have to hand in how many hours a month you were doing on the ministry. And of course, it was kind of incentivized to do more and more. Mm. And so I suddenly went from being so busy, all my time occupied, to nothing. And I went from being very social and knowing loads of people to nobody. And there was this horrific void. And I knew I had to write. And so I started writing. And when my daughter, who was maybe about 3 at the time, my eldest daughter, I would put her to bed. And because I was kind of conditioned to, in the evening you do something because time had always been full, I'd put her to bed and I would go into the kitchen and I would write. And I found that I was beginning to write things that I'd been really afraid to express. And I was kind of writing these sort of strange short stories and fables. I didn't really understand what they were. I didn't have a clue what I was doing. And I think it was just this sort of madness of not, you know, not really having an identity that was mine either. And I very quickly kind of fixated on the, I'm going to become a writer. And so I did an evening class at Edinburgh Uni, and the tutor there said, you're good. And that was the first time that someone had really said, you know, you're good at something. And so I thought, right, I'm going to do that. And it felt like a very kind of very deliberate report back to the Witnesses as well, back to that kind of, you can't speak out, you can't say anything, nothing was created, nothing was invented. It was like you would read the Watchtower and then you had to answer the right answer to the question. There was never a formulate something of your own. And I realized that I didn't even know how to think. And I realized that writing for me at that stage was a way of knowing what I felt about something, because I could write down lots of different ideas and kind of coalesce into something else. So I do think it was kind of a way of becoming sane and then staying sane at that point in time. And it's kind of changed over the years, but it certainly, you know, at its simplest level, I think it kept me alive, and it moved me away from a very rigid black and white way of thinking to just existing in that kind of shade of grey, that complexity.
A brilliant answer. All right, I want to move on to your new book, Ava Anna Ada. It's out on the 18th of January. I was lucky enough to read an advanced copy of it, and I sat down and read it in an afternoon and literally could not put it down. I just loved it. The book centers around Anna, who is a mother, and she's lost her daughter, whose name is Ada. The novel starts when a young woman called Ava shows up in the middle of a torrential rain event, and Anna's dog is lying, dying on the front lawn. The novel is set in something of a near future or an alternative present, perhaps, and there's quite a lot of people waiting for this doomsday event within the book. Without giving too much away, do you want to tell us about just those central characters of Anna and Ava to start with?
Yes. So Anna is a lot older than Ava. Anna is perhaps in her early 40s, and she is an influencer. So she spends all her days constructing this reality for what is referred to as the screen. So I didn't want to date the book in any way. So it's just the screen, and she's, you know, making her life appear to be one thing. She's obviously trying to fill a void that was left by her daughter, Ada. She's recently bereaved, and her husband and her young son, Adam, you get a sense of the names and all the wordplay as well. Yeah. Her and her family have moved to this very rural place to do up an old mill, in the tradition of most influencers who have to have a renovation project once they've finished having their babies. So Anna's there in this new circumstance, and I became really fascinated thinking, you know, what happens when you move, that kind of dislocation and relocation, and thinking of it almost as bones being broken and reset as well. It's very medical terminology to use. We've relocated, you know, and I thought, no, this is interesting. And I kept thinking of someone who'd been really devastated. And again, that's such a architectural word, you know, or a storm word that she herself had been devastated by this huge event that had happened to her. And in trying to put the pieces back together, they'd bought this house, and then she encounters Ava. And I just like thinking of the cataclysm of, I've put these people in this rural place, these are city people, and then they encounter this girl who is a really strong voice. I had so much fun writing Ava, but she is a local prostitute, and she's doing it to be enterprising. There's no other jobs. So as she says, she's doing what she can with what she's got. And she thinks that she's super smart, and she thinks she's very streetwise because she's encountered so many different kinds of men. So she thinks she's manipulating everyone. And it does appear that everyone who comes close to Ava gets destroyed. But at the same time, there's the kind of the idea of responsibility, and she's being manipulated by people who are a lot older than her. People are using her for their own advantage as well. And I love thinking about how when we're teenagers, we think we're really grown up and that we know everything because we know more than we ever have, but we really don't get how the world works. So kind of ostensibly, Ava is very grown up for her age, and she's very exploitative. And then as the book progresses, you start to wonder about that as well. But I would say that they're two very complicated main characters, and I had so much fun making them up and the kind of interplay between the two of them. So what they do is they both recant the exact same event, but from their perspective. And we don't really know who they're recounting it to or for what ends as well. And I really enjoyed switching between the two and having these two voices that are very insistent and very different, but create such a kind of visceral feeling in the reader too.
You create this really fantastic kind of echoing feeling with this book, because with it, like, we can go to the names for a start. We've got Ava, Anna, and Ada, all of which are palindromes. And then everybody in the book is kind of echoing the other's actions. So we have everybody kind of manipulating each other for their own ends as well. So we get this real visceral theme of this idea that everyone's trying to get something out of everybody. And that's played back beautifully within these names that you put in the book. We've even got the brother who's called Adam, which is Ada with an M at the end. But I just want to talk about that idea of, like, having this kind of, it's almost like a circular structure within the book. But tell me about, like, putting in those elements, especially with those palindromes with the names, and how that kind of feeds out into the rest of the book.
Yeah, so I wanted it to be that at the center of the book, there's an absence. That absence is obviously Ada. Mm-hmm. We never have Ada's voice. We never really hear Ava, although Adam parrots a lot of what Ada has said at points in time. But I suppose I constructed the whole idea of the book around what happens when there's that void, what happens when there's this absence. Mm-hmm. So Ada is the central whole and the kind of central haunting. So because it's essentially a book about being haunted by someone not being there anymore, and the sort of everything that grows out of that, then I needed it to be that it is essentially an echo. It's almost like a call and refrain as well, that one person says, this is what happens, and then the next person takes up the thread and says, no, this is what happens. And of course, everything becomes very shaky very quickly, and everything becomes very uncertain. And it's set over the course of a very hot week as well, and the heat is that build as well that kind of echoes and grows throughout it. But I got quite obsessed with hauntings and images, and of course an image is a removal from the source anyway, and now we're so, in terms of how reality on the screen is constructed within the book, but also within our lives, we're so far removed from originals that all of our life is essentially an echo of someone else's inspiration, someone else's idea. And so it was really important that I kind of just, that is the refrain really, and the recurring thing throughout the book. And of course, Anna sees Ada, or thinks she sees Ada, a lot of the time as well. And that very real thing that can happen when you're bereaved. And I wanted to explore the madness of grief as well. And that grief, we like to hope that grief is linear, because it would be really comfortable to believe that it is. It would be great to believe that it is a 12-step process or whatever, but it's not. And so because it's circular and because it loops, that's what I needed to make sure was happening within the book, that Anna goes on a circle. She can't break out of the circle. She can't move towards not seeing Ada. So yeah, that was very important to me, that I kind of brought this, well, reality in a way to how grief can work, and how it can unhinge you, and how it can make you stuck. And it haunts you, but it keeps you moving in a circle, which the mode of narration does as well, that I'm constantly moving the reader around the same event, so they're not moving forward either, so there isn't a linearity to it, although there also is, you know, moving through the week.
There's also this sense that Ava is stuck within, sorry, that Anna is stuck within this world of, let's say, we'll call it Instagram, or, you know, or the screen, as you call it in the book, but she's stuck with grieving repeatedly and trying to find new ways to grieve over Ada, because it gets her likes and it gets her more popular. And so she continues this cycle of this ever kind of growing sense that she needs to produce new content for this, you know, for the screen, for people to grieve with her and to feel, you know, what she's feeling. And you do get that really circular sense of this thing that she's on, that she just has to keep on doing what she's doing, keep on grieving.
Yeah. And she has monetized her grief, and she's built her brand around the fact that she's got a dead daughter. So how do you stop grieving when your dead daughter is your livelihood? And I have noticed that on the screen on Instagram, that a lot of people have to follow the same preoccupations because that's what works with the brand. And so, but when you think of how that works psychologically, of course you become stuck, because you can't then be, well, I'm going to be something else, or I'm going to focus on something that might actually help me break this circle as well. And I suppose that I really understand that, because it would have been very easy for me to be the poster girl for someone who's left Jehovah's Witnesses, and I would spend the next 10 years revisiting trauma that I don't want to revisit, but I would be in the trap of, well, I wrote this book about it, so I've got to do it. And I think we live in a society that wants to pigeonhole us and wants us to be a brand and to conform within those parameters. But how healthy is that? Well, I'm not sure it's particularly healthy. And I wanted to talk about that as well, that Anna's kind of dug herself into this hole because she can't suddenly rebrand. So where does she go next?
Yeah.
And she's obviously always looking for somewhere to go next.
Yeah.
And then I also noticed this very strange thing that sometimes happens on Instagram, is that people will suddenly flex to being experts on something else, and the degree to which you're an expert online is often questionable, because you can say you know something about anything and people go, oh yeah, they must know because they've said it loudly.
Yeah.
The thing online, if you say it loud enough, then you've got enough authority. So she does that in the book. She suddenly starts kind of aligning herself as being a local. And she knows about this huge catastrophe that's coming. Of course, she doesn't know anything. And there's a lot of people in the village who'd be much more well qualified to speak. But she's got her platform and she's got her audience. And that's what we're looking for, really, isn't it? People with numbers. And the idea of numbers obviously comes into the book as well, the way that we measure people and the way we measure ourselves.
Yeah. I want to get onto that, because you mentioned the catastrophe in your last response. But in this book, we get these hints about the world that a book is set in, because it is a bit different to our world. And there's this impending sense of doom. We've got some climate change kind of events coming on. There are like hints about food shortages. There's travel restrictions. There's police kind of stopping people moving around quite a bit. I don't want to talk too much about details of the plot, because I feel like I don't want to ruin any of the aspects of the novel for people, because it is so good. But I just want you to tell us a tiny bit about this world the novel's set in.
Yeah, so it's, in my mind, it's near future, but none of it is beyond the realms of possibility. I think, like many people in the UK, there's been this growing sense of horror ever since the Tories were elected, really. And barely elected, ever since they came to power. And you can watch something and you can see it coming, and there's a horrible sense that of inevitability. There's a horrible sense of how small and helpless we actually are against these systems that we believed were democratic and there to protect us. And I feel that really we're moving towards eroding democracy, and it's felt like that in the UK for the last, I'd love to say 10 years, but actually it's 13 years now, isn't it? Yeah. This is really entrenched. It's almost, you can't quite remember the before times. And one of the most alarming things that I noticed was the fact that increasingly it's about how we value people and how we value lives. And COVID obviously completely exposed that, you know, the government, just the certain fast sections of society, they just don't care about. And if you don't fall within the ableist capitalist idea that, you know, your body can be used to create more capital, then you're of no value. And that's where there's a value meter. Everybody's house has a value meter in it, and their value can go up or down contingent on many factors. And I thought, I don't see that we're far off it. We used to measure people in terms of the money they made. And yeah, we still do, but it's a lot more than that. Even the way we talk about medical conditions, you know, now people talk about preventable cancers as if, well, are we grading cancer even? It's, well, you got it because you did something you shouldn't have done, whereas this person got it by accident, so we'll treat them first. And that's another way of ranking conditions. It's another way of ranking how we treat people. And so I became really concerned with that. So I wanted that kind of as the background architecture. But at the same time, I didn't want it to be me worried and shouting in a book because you're not going to engage anybody. So I wanted kind of the lightness of touch that we're in a future world that could be a present world. As the reader, you don't need to know how they got there because you need to use your imagination and you need to realize that, you know, we're not too sure how we got here, but we're here. And so I wanted it to be just almost at one remove, but that you can imagine these kind of very authoritarian measures start creeping in because they have. But I didn't want it to be an issues book. We spoke about this beforehand, and I just switch off with issues books. I don't find them engaging. You know, I'm not an expert. I've done work in climate change before, and I was handling about 13 years ago a lot of really worrying data sets and predictions, which did kickstart a lot of the thinking for Ada. And Ada was, you know, climate change at that point was kind of future tense, but we definitely, it's shifted. And I use a line about Leo in the book that he's shifted in tense and position. But that's what climate change has done is we are now, it's present tense, and yet everyone's just preoccupied with their screens, and we've kind of been lulled by tech giants. I think we've been done a huge disservice to, actually. And so the interplay as to how have we got to this stage of almost acceptance and inevitability, well, that hugely links in with social media and different representations of reality when actually, you know, a huge event is coming towards us and it's too big for us to capture. It's too big to take photos of, which makes it impossible for us kind of to contend as real when our whole idea of reality is now based on what's seen on the screen, which the irony is that now most of that's AI generated as well. So it's really odd times that we live in. So I wanted it kind of to be odd times in the book.
Yeah. I think you do this with such a light touch in the book, like having these value meters on the door. Like, it reminds me of the Chinese social credit score, which is actually in play at the moment, which is an insane idea. But what freaks me out about this book is how, like, it seems like such a fine line between what we have now and what you portray in this book. Because, like, I think we all saw over COVID how easy it was for governments to go, well, you can't do this now. You can't go to the park now. You can't, you know, you can't travel now. You can't leave your area now. And like, for the most part, everybody just went, okay, no worries. It's for the good. And I think it's such a slippery slope, because I'm going to piss some people off. But I think it's the kind of thing where when people are so easily able to just accept these changes in society, like I feel like the next thing will just happen and we won't, you know, there won't be anybody saying, you know, that's not really good for us. I think people just seem to be very happily, strolling on their phones and going through Instagram and not really watching what's happening.
I completely agree with you. And I think that's the thing, is that, you know, the phrase you used is for the good. As soon as you start telling people that something's for the greater good or a collective good, they're much more likely to do it. Of course, I know that from growing up. I thought everything that I did was for the good, whereas actually I had some really horrible judgmental right-wing views, but they were for the good. And so as soon as you bring that in, and I think also we've been conditioned through film in particular, that these kind of that authoritarian things happen very quickly, and you don't understand that there's a gradual erosion before that, or the apocalypse happens very quickly, and they're visual and they're discernible, and you can pinpoint them. You can say on X date, you know, history tells us, you can say on X date this happened and this is how we got to where we are. But it's not actually how it works. And so I became really interested in that as well, just how it works very gradually. And I started to think too, well, what if the apocalypse has been and we didn't see it, because we always thought that it was going to come with the four horsemen and Jesus on the clouds, and it was going to be this cataclysm. But what if the cataclysm is moving into post-reality, into being able to be manipulated by these giants who are so much bigger than us? And I thought that that was a really interesting thing. And I also, when I was constructing the world, I had read in the past that Margaret Atwood said about The Handmaid's Tale, that although she'd set it in a different world, everything in The Handmaid's Tale is something that had already happened, so that it was more that our present is dystopian. And I think that that's the thing, is that, you know, we're in very dystopian times. And so I needed to construct a world that was believable, even if it hadn't happened. And so it's just that little, that little subtle kind of shift underneath.
Yeah. Paul, I don't know, I just loved it. So congratulations. I want to ask about White Rabbit, because they are coming out with some of the, just some amazing books. I know that they are theoretically part of, you know, a bigger publishing world, but they do their completely own thing. And Lee Braxton over there just seems to run such a great publishing house. But I want to ask you about working with them.
Yeah, it's great. So I love David Keane, and I came to David's work accidentally. So I went to the Lodge of Monument Maker, and I thought it was a book about buildings and monuments. And I really like buildings. I've got a thing about, like, I like buildings. I particularly like buildings that are made of stone. And so I thought, oh, great, I'll go to this. And I arrived, and it like started with a kind of incantation. And I thought, oh, this is an interesting book event, not been to something like this before. And then David leapt out onto the stage and was David Keenan with all his energy, and I very quickly realized it wasn't a book about buildings, although it also kind of is.
It also kind of is,
and
yeah.
So yeah, so that was my first encounter with White Rabbit. It was quite a startling encounter, and then of course I realized that Lee was a very established editor and has worked with some incredible people. I'm a big fan of DBC Pierre, and Sarah Hall, and people who he'd worked with at Faber. And then realizing that there's that kind of expertise with the sensibility of this quite, I'm not going to use the word crazy, I think risk-taking is probably the word. And what drew me to White Rabbit is the fact that a lot of publishers aren't taking risks, although they'll say, oh, it's a business of risk. It's a business of finding a book that sits closely aligned to another book that was very successful. So can we make that one make us as much money as that other one? Tends to be how it goes across commercial publishing. But I think that at White Rabbit, that's not how it goes. At White Rabbit, it's, are you doing something interesting? Are you disrupting something? And fundamentally also, are you good at your job? You know, and that's another thing that I really like, is that the books that White Rabbit are putting out, particularly the novel list, it's such a strong list of incredible writers. And to be a debut alongside David Keenan and Richard Millward is such a kind of, well, it feels a bit like a badge of honor. And when you say to people within the industry where you're at, they kind of immediately assume that the book must be okay. So yeah, I think it's the risk-taking sensibilities that really drew me to them as a publisher. And then of course, the great thing as well though, is that they've got the machine of a big publisher behind them as well, so that you've got the best of both, because it's so hard to be an indie out there at the moment. So yeah, I feel exceptionally lucky, and I feel like it's exciting and it's great to feel that you're with a publisher who will take risks, particularly working on subsequent work, thinking, well, I can go down what I'm interested in, and I don't want to produce something that I don't feel 100% invested in as well. I want to be completely preoccupied with what I'm making. So it's great to have the chance to make stuff that's a bit provocative.
Awesome. All right. Well, with that, I want to ask you, what are you working on next?
I'm working on a couple of things that I won't go into specifics about. I tend to, when I was working on The Last Days, I was also working on Ava and Ada, and now I'm working on another project and another one, and it just seems to be how my brain works, that I like to be able to switch between two. But the funny thing that I'm realizing now is that those preoccupations that are recur throughout this kind of, now I'm beginning to make a body of work, and I think, oh, that's, I'm telling the same story just in a different way. And I think that most writers have two or three things that they're really interested in, and they just go into that. I think of it as going like narrow and deep, just keep going into this kind of thing that you need to mine until it's done. But I'm working on kind of exploring the body and the forces that exist on the body as well, and I'm finding that just incredible. My undergrad was in textiles, and it's a lot of fun to kind of, I feel like I'm combining the two finally. I always felt quite disparate to have textiles and text. And then, of course, I should have thought about that, because the etymology of both is exactly the same.
Yeah.
So it's a fabric, it's a tissue. And so yeah, that's taken up most of my brain space the last few months. So it's quite funny to be now talking about something that I've finished making, and now I'm back in the world of Ava and Ada. But I definitely think each book informs the next manuscript, and there's a point at which you're writing one that the other one starts to grow, and you think, this has given birth to something new, which is amazing as well. So it kind of, a bit of a snowball, I suppose.
Wow, cool. Okay, that will be very exciting when we get to see those new projects. All right, I want to move on to your gateway books. What were some of the books that opened the world of literature for you, apart from Jane Eyre?
Well, obviously, we can't neglect the big Bible-shaped elephant in the room. So I would say the Bible was the first book, and not in ways that I've seen other writers describe. Nothing about beautiful passages or any of this. The Bible that I grew up with was a very simplified version. It was the Witness's own translation.
Yeah.
And that, as when losing my faith in that, had a massive effect on my understanding of narrative, because until then I'd seen it as the truth and the one true book. And then I realized how it was presented really with bias and intent. It was kind of a manipulation of the original source, and that had a massive effect. And also seeing that it's narrated by so many different people, so there's these kind of glaring inconsistencies in how stories should work. It's not the most seamless of stories. And so that had a huge effect. But when I was exploring this idea of narrative being untrustworthy, the three books that kind of worked the most for me when I left The Witnesses were older books. Young Adam, Alexander Trockey's Young Adam, had a massive effect. And I think you can probably pick that up in Ava and Ada, because of course they're narrating the same thing from different perspectives. Mm-hmm. And Young Adam blew the possibilities of what a narrator could do just out the water for me. I read that when I was still a witness, but kind of edging away. And I used to keep it hidden. I think I keep it like down the side of my bed. And I love the narrator in that, Joe, how he tells you one version of events, and you're quite invested in him. You think he's quite nice. You don't even suspect that he's not. And then the second half of the book well, you just go, whoa, he's completely done something else here. And in much the same vein, John Fowles, The Collector, does a really similar thing, where, and it's horrific. I've read both of them. I think they're probably the books I've returned to the most.
Yeah.
And again, you're reading that just thinking, oh my goodness, he's telling me one thing and he's doing something completely different. And it's horrifying as you're reading it. And of course you get the girl's voice comes in and they're very much split texts. And Ava Anaida is like that, but I didn't want to go down the Anna tells us one version and it's a big chunk and then Ava tells us the other big chunk. I wanted it to be that just that switching so that it kind of destabilizes the reader even more. But they were probably are like my two big influences. And then, and of course, Nabokov's Lolita as well. Huge, again, coming back to that unreliable narrator, but the tension of what that does to the reader and how unsettling it becomes.
Brilliant. Okay. Now, what great choices, especially like with your work as well. They all fit in so well.
And I think the other one, just one more, was when I was doing an MA in creative writing, I read Ben Marcus's The Flame Alphabet.
And how good is that?
Oh, so good.
That's a spooky book.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was the same thing of just how unsettling it is and how centered around language it is as well. And yeah, that book had a huge effect on me. It had a huge effect on what I wanted to write because it's so grounded in theory too, but isn't a theoretical book. It's just a really good read. But yeah, really, really unsettling book.
Definitely. Cool. All right. I want to ask you what books you're currently reading or have you recently enjoyed or are you looking forward to?
The book that I enjoyed the most over the last year was Bret Easton Ellis's The Shards.
I was telling Seth when I interviewed him a couple of days ago that was one of my picks of the year as well.
Yeah, definitely one of my picks of the year. It's just incredible, isn't it? And so it's so unsettling too. And I love what he does. I love that he did same thing in American Psycho is that you're trying to figure out if it's true. Not true, but you're trying to figure out, oh, did Bateman kill people? Who's doing the murders in this? And you get really preoccupied with it. And then you suddenly have to take a step back and go, it's all made up. It's a novel. But I'm getting, is this really happening? And can I, how can I trust this person? And is it this person? And then you think, it's none of them. You know, he sat in a room and wrote it. But it's brilliant. And I think for such a big book, because is it not about 800 pages?
Yeah, it's close to it, yeah.
It's so big. And I think I read it in about 4 days. I read it so quickly. I absolutely loved it. And Richard Millward's Man Eating Typewriter as well.
Okay, we are so on the same page because those are literally like two of my top books of the year.
I was sent an advanced copy of Richard's book and I interviewed him for his launch. And I love it. It's so playful. I think it's linguistically one of the most playful books I've read in a long time. And it's so much fun when you realize that there's a game afoot and you see that there's the bolded kind of off type. And you think, hang on a minute, something's going on. And the way he handles time in that book as well, and how much that adds to the tension and the plot too, because you see that it's speeding up.
Yeah.
I just think absolutely brilliant book. And I felt so lucky to have that. And I think I read it just after The Shards. So I had like this brilliant reading start to the year. And then kind of took a dive, I think, but I also have been very busy. Couple of books I'm looking forward to next year, Kieran Goddard's I See Buildings Fall Like Lightning. So Kieran wrote Hourglass, which is a very short novel. I think it was out 2022. And yeah, it was out just before The Last Days. And now his next one's out just after Eva and Aida. And I See Buildings Fall Like Lightning follows five friends and kind of five different lives and five different eventualities. What I loved about it is Kieran is just a beautiful writer. Like every sentence is gorgeous. And he really observes things really kind of acutely and isn't afraid to put that on the page. I think it's quite unusual writing for a male as well. It's kind of good, but I think that a lot of female readers will really resonate with. It's a female character in it who's so well done, really, really sympathetically portrayed. And it's just, yeah, it's a beautiful book. So I really recommend that as well.
We'll take a quick break here on Beyond Zero. We're speaking with Ali Miller. Do you have young kids? Do you struggle to get trustworthy babysitters at a reasonable price? Well, why not try Golem Babysitting Services, proud sponsors of this week's episode. Here's a few words from one of our highly qualified professionals.
When Golem say go the fuck to sleep, he mean it, and children go to sleep. I have many years experience.
We love you, Golem!
Use promo code Where's My Dick for 10% off your first booking. It's time for Ali's Desert Island Books.
Well, I would take Nick Laird's Up Late because you can't go to a desert island without having some poetry. And Up Late is his last collection, which actually was another book I loved last year, this year. And it's beautiful. It has at its center an incredible poem called Up Late about his father's death. And I think it's one of the things I've returned to the most throughout this year. So I would take it to the island with me because I would struggle without it. I would also have to take to an island Norton's Anthology of Theory and Criticism because I'm that much fun. I would take it rather than, and this is me actually thinking through the practicalities of the space that I have in my suitcase. I would take it because it's got most of the kind of thinking that I go, oh crap, where's this book? And I have to run around the house to find the right book. Mm-hmm. So I would take it. I would take, I've obviously mentioned it before, but I would take The Collector. Definitely take John Powell's The Collector because it's dark and it's horrible and it's just compelling. And I return to it a lot. I would take David Keenan's For the Good Times.
Okay.
For the good times because of the scene with the salmon. It's so funny. And I think if you're on a desert island, you need to laugh. And that's a funny part in the book. I really love that book. I would take that one, which is probably an unusual one to choose. I mean, Monument Maker would keep me occupied for longer. Mm-hmm. But I've got my Norton's Anthology, so I don't need to be overly occupied. I'm trying to think, do you have to, is it, you're on the island to relax or you're on the island to work?
Theoretically, you're stuck there forever, so.
Okay, so I'm working on the island.
Yeah.
So books that help me with work. Sarah Hall's How to Paint a Dead Man, because it's so insanely good. I'm still reading that, like, I'm not still reading it, I read it. But I go back to it sometimes just to read passages going, like, what the hell was she doing? Mm. So I would take it so that I could maybe begin to figure out what was happening and what she was doing. Lydia Davis, I would take her collected short stories. I think it's a big one.
So the essays or the short stories?
The short stories. Yeah, I would take that because I want to get right into the heart of what she's doing with language and how she pairs it back. I would take Gabriel Marcus's Lipstick Tracies because that keeps your brain occupied for a long time. And And I love, what I love with Greil Marcus is how he takes you on sort of, it's not tangential work, but he introduces so much culture that there's kind of like that you're always being sent in different directions and you never come away from it knowing what you knew before you come away from it, so much richer. And if you're stuck on an island, you want that. And I would also take Nigel Slater's The Kitchen Diaries.
Yeah.
So I don't think I've ever spoken about my love of cookbooks, but I love cooking. Mm-hmm. And I don't like recipes because I feel like I'm being told what to do, but I love reading Nigel Slater because it's pure escapism.
Mm-hmm.
And he just creates this gorgeous world so completely that he kind of makes you inhabit and you feel like, when I'm reading him, I'm like, oh yeah, I just popped to Barrow Market and buy some cheese and some sourdough and my fridge is just full of these amazing ingredients and it's not. And he just constructs this version so completely that it's beautiful and it's brilliantly done. I would have to take some more novels so I wasn't just working. I would take Moby Dick because it's fantastic and it's real escapism. Although it might make you quite upset when you're on an island reading that much about the sea. It could be quite traumatic. I'm trying to think what else I would take. I think I'd have to take something really classic that I've not read. Then I might really not like it. I'll take War and Peace. I've not read War and Peace, so I would take it because I think there's probably a high chance that I would like it. Yeah.
And if you don't, you can use it for firewood.
Exactly, and it would be quite good because it's big.
Yeah.
I've always struggled with Jane Austen, and I always want to think that I'm going to crack Jane Austen and get really into Jane Austen, and it just can't do it, so I wouldn't take that because I know my limits. That wouldn't go with me. Say I'm going to take something by Cormac McCarthy, but you have to be careful with that as well on a desert island, don't you? You don't want to go too...
You don't want to go too dark, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think this is my tendency. I do fear towards the darkness. I feel that I need something that's quite a bit more up than down. So
one of my summer reading plans is to read Sutri by Cormac McCarthy. I've been told that's kind of a lighter, darker book. So apparently it's quite...
Oh, I could take that. That might work then.
It's quite thick. Did you like the new ones? Did you read the new ones yet?
Yes.
What did you think?
I thought they were brilliant. I thought it was so clever.
Yeah.
And I loved the kind of the companion pieces.
Yeah.
As it were, which I suppose is kind of a little bit of what Ava and Aida is trying to do. So I really, really enjoyed them. I thought they were great. I actually read them for research for what I'm trying to do in the future.
Yeah. Wow.
It was really, really brilliant. And I'm really frustrated because there is a book in my head that I would take and I can't remember what it is. So I would probably just have to take lots of notebooks and try and write one as well.
Cool. All right. Well, we should probably wrap it up with you. It has been such a pleasure speaking to you. I absolutely loved The Last Days, but I think Ava and Aida is, I don't know if it's a better book, but it's something that it just blew me away. I read it so quickly that, it's an unbelievable read. It just packs such a punch and it has so many twists, but it's just brilliant. I love it. It's been a pleasure chatting with you. Before I let you go, do you want to tell us where we can get your book, your books, and where we can get in touch with you online?
Yes. So the books are available from all reputable and disreputable booksellers. So you just search there. I think if you pop onto White Rabbit's website, that's probably the best place to find out all the different places you can buy it. I am on Twitter and on Instagram completely unironically and slightly hypocritically. I'm just having a look because I don't actually know who I am on Twitter. I am Ali_L_Miller, Miller with an A, as I always say. And I think I'm the same on Instagram as well. But yeah, I'm quite findable. So you'll be able to find me there and follow. And also, actually, I'm on Substack too. And
you went to Substack?
Yeah. And I'm actually having a lot of fun with it. So I started Substack without a clue what I was doing, like most people, I think. And then I had this, I was teaching a few months ago, and we were teaching students to kind of loosen themselves up, but also work within a constraint so that they kind of got new things coming at them. And I thought, I wonder what would happen if I tried to do like a 10-minute snapshot of my day every day, like I'm taking a photo, just this is what's happening, but also kind of let my mind wander. So you're playing with that lens, zooming in and out, and take 10 minutes to write it and just write it down. So I've been doing it. I think I've missed about 5 days over the past month and a bit. So it's been really good fun. And it's really influenced the rest of my work, actually. It's helped change the perspective a little bit. Mm. So yeah, you can find me on Substack, and my Substack is, I think, Ali Miller's 3 AM things, because I'm chronic insomniac, and it was initially going to be the things I thought at 3 in the morning, but that would have been just too dark, so yeah. Went with 10 minutes of my more conscious state.
Brilliant. All right. Thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you. I'll put all those links in the show notes as well. But yeah, congratulations on the book. Congratulations on the last days. But yeah, just lovely chatting. And yeah, we should do this again.
Oh, I'd love to. Yeah, definitely.
Thanks once again to Ali Miller. Check out the show notes for all the details. You can find us on X and Instagram at Beyond Zero Pod, and you can email us at beyondzeropod@gmail.com. You can support this podcast by heading over to patreon.com and searching for Beyond Zero. Very happy new year. We'll be back with the next episode very soon.